Welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Today we'll continue with a reading from The Ice Dancer, read to us by its author Connie Ellis of Duluth. The Ice Dancer takes place someplace north of Two Harbors up in Canada and includes wilderness lakes, saunas, and opera-loving sled dogs. Continuing now with The Ice Dancer.
"I have a funny feeling," Fawn says. "Well, just drive up slowly," Greta says, puzzled by Fawn's apprehension, which she now feels a touch of in herself. They drive the rest of the way at 10 kilometers. An hour. The driveway has been cleanly plowed and the snow shoveled away from the front door. "Looks normal," Greta says. "It does. But let me come in with you. Let's just see." The porch door opens stiffly in the cold. A small drift of snow has blown in onto the porch floor, as it usually does after a storm. Greta decides she'll sweep it up later, after she unpacks and warms up the house. They both see it at the same time and freeze. A large footprint in the light dusting of snow on the porch floor, near the inner door. "Just Karloff, probably. Maybe he came in to check the water pipes, though mine never seemed to freeze." "He knows that," Greta says, trying to explain the footprint. "Shh," Fawn says, "just listen." They listen to the pines creaking in the wind, and in the distance, Tom chopping wood. "Okay, let's go in," Fawn says. Greta slides her key in the lock and knows immediately that the door is unlocked, decides not to tell Fawn. She opens the door slowly and steps inside. It looks normal, but something feels funny to her, too. She puts her suitcase on the couch and is ready to check the rooms, trying to act as though she's not afraid. Yet, she waits for Fawn to walk from room to room with her. The bathroom door is closed nearly all the way. She's quite sure she left it wide open. To boost her confidence, she swings the door open wide and walks in. No one. Nothing. She turns on the hot water faucet to warm the pipes. There are long black hairs in the sink. She shudders and beckons for Fawn to come look. "Oh, Greta, we've got to get out of here. I'll call Sheriff Banzoff from my place. Come on." They grab their purses and leave the cabin quickly. Greta doesn't lock the door, but once inside Fawn's car, they lock all the doors and Fawn drives down the driveway as quickly as possible. Considering the snowy ruts, Greta looks out the back window as they drive away, sees no one around the cabin. They drive in silence to Fawn's house and arrive tired but relieved to find the house looking normal. After Fawn calls the sheriff, they settle themselves at the kitchen table. "Eat something, Greta. We haven't eaten since Dorothy's French toast this morning," Fawn says, twirling the angel hair pasta into a manageable bite. "An apple," Greta says. "One of those yellow ones." Fawn passes the wooden bowl of fruit to Greta, who takes an apple and some purple grapes. "I love grapes," Fawn says, breaking off a large bunch. "Me too," Greta says. She's hungry and the fruit tastes delicious. She can't eat the pasta. She keeps thinking of the brochure Karloff got from the vet with a color picture of long, stringy heartworms. Bandit died of heartworm, and now Greta expects the pasta on her plate to start squirming. She knows she'd never sleep if she ate any of it, at least not tonight. Fawn clears the table and comes back with a fresh pot of coffee. Her coffee is always delicious and clear because she grinds the beans and puts an eggshell in with the grounds. "Caffeine-free," she says, filling 2 gold-edged porcelain cups. They drink their coffee and wait for the sheriff to return from Greta's. "I don't like this waiting. It makes me think of Monique and the time of the accident," Fawn says. "But I don't feel sad. I mean, I feel close to Monique at times, as though she's with me, part of me. I hate to admit it, but I think I feel closer to her with her gone than when she was alive. Isn't life just Oh, inexplicable? She shakes her head and rubs the side of her cup as if to invoke a genie or Monique. You said it, Greta says, wondering why she's had no sense of Gabriel's presence for the last 3 days, and realizes she misses him, and she knows what Fawn is talking about, that sense of closeness. But how can she miss him? Really, now, how? They're both tired by the time Sheriff Banzov pulls up. His report doesn't alarm them. They had both been imagining the worst, probably after the ghost stories in the car during the drive north. The place is basically clean, he tells them. He found more black hairs, long ones, on the quilt in the bedroom, and an empty can of beans under the sink that he didn't think could have been there for more than a day, but no dirty pans or dishes. Whoever it was very careful and cleaned up after himself, he says. And he talked to Karloff, who hadn't noticed anything unusual this morning when he plowed the drive, though he said the shed door was half open when he went to get the shovel, but he hadn't thought anything of it at the time. Are you sure you locked up when you went down to Thunder Bay? He asked Greta. It was quite early, and she hadn't been sleeping well, that's true, but she thinks she must have locked the door, though she never locks it when she makes a quick trip into Red Otter. I probably locked it, Greta says. Well, I found some snowshoe tracks, just a couple down next to the boathouse. The storm covered everything else. Could have been a trapper caught out in the blizzard. You know, there are some Cree families out there, way back in the woods past the falls. They might have trap lines up this way. Doesn't Latos buy maple syrup from one of those guys? I'm pretty sure they come in maybe twice a year. I'll talk to him in the morning. I think you can go on home, Greta. I don't think we have anything to worry about here. Or stay here tonight and go home in the morning, Fawn suggests. I'd like to do that, she tells Fawn as she yawns. It's going to be okay, she decides. They thank Sheriff Banzoff, and Fawn offers him a cup of coffee, but he says it's too late and wishes them a good evening, tells them to lock up just to be on the safe side, and he'll come out or call in the morning after he talks to Latos. After the sheriff leaves, their tension pretty much dissipates, and both Fawn and Greta start yawning excessively. Good night, good night, good night, Fawn says finally. Night, Greta says through a last yawn. Oddly, after the excitement of the day, both Fawn and Greta are relaxed and thinking of little else other than sleep. In Fawn's guest room, Greta is cozy and comfortable under a mountainous cloud of a feather bed, where she quickly falls asleep. The white place, rest here in this emptiness, in this place of nothing, in this snow. Chapter 9. Gabriel is hoping Dave will like the present he bought for him, the Canadian Sky Four Seasons. He's wrapped it in paper he found with sun and moons, which isn't Christmas paper, but nevertheless seems right. He has only time for a quick stop to drop it off before he leaves for rehearsal. He's doing the Nutcracker this Christmas, for the first time in 6 years. Getting out of the car, he sees Dave has decorated an outdoor tree for the birds. The spruce by the back door is covered with scraps of food tied on with grocery twine. Whole pieces of bread are tied around various tips, like pine needle hot dogs, and various unidentifiable items deck the boughs. A small strand of popcorn dangles from the top of the tree, and a rope of cranberries circles the lower branches. The main feeder beside the spruce is piled high with birdseed, and Dave has attached a wire cage filled with suet next to his front door. Gabriel is sure Dave is the only person in Canada who has suet nailed to his house rather than to a tree or post. Dave has the door open and is waiting for Gabriel, a chunk of blue cheese in his hand, which apparently he has been eating like a candy bar. Like my tree? Come on in. I've got chickadees, blue jays, bunting, sparrows. Wait till you see what I got. I got a present from Tia. He rushes into the living room to find the present. She gave me a camera, he says, hurrying back. And here, see her note? He hands it to Gabriel before taking the last bite of the blue cheese. Dear Dave, I hope you enjoy the camera. Shoot some photos instead of guns. Tia. That's very nice, Gabriel says, handing back the note. Zoom lens, Dave says. I thought I'd start on the chickadees. Gabriel gives Dave the skybook. When he opens it immediately, When he turns the page, Gabriel has to remind him he can't stay long. He has to drive into Winnipeg, but he's pleased Dave is already absorbed in the book. You get a book too, Dave says, handing Gabriel his Christmas present, wrapped in creased and wrinkled paper with a birthday cake and balloon motif. Gabriel's book is called Wildlife of North America, with a wolf on the cover and a turtle on the back. Dave skims the book, which has a lot of photographs, more wolves and turtles, also deer, moose, eagles, bear, chipmunks, fish, and birds. There's a long chapter on birds. More than 150 varieties of waterfowl migrate to the southern edges of Lake Manitoba each year, he reads. He slaps Dave on the back. Damn, he says. Thanks. Gotta run. Back in his car, he says, I talk like Dave, and laughs. He's happy. It's a good Christmas. A week after their return from Thunder Bay, Greta is at the top of the ladder, knocking snow off the roof with a bamboo fishing pole when Fawn drives up. Light snow is floating down in small clumps. Easy snow, she says, climbing down to Fawn. Not that crusty stuff we had last week. 50.7 inches. That's our average snowfall, Fawn says as they take off their boots on the porch. I heard it on the radio this morning. Churchill gets 77 inches. Beautiful moccasins. A Christmas present? Greta tells how she found the soft deerskin moccasins wrapped in a rabbit skin tied up with rawhide on her front steps yesterday morning when she went out to the bird feeder, and that they're a perfect fit. Indeed, she's never had such comfortable shoes. They both admire the craftsmanship of the soft, cold moccasins. Greta slips them on and walks in silent comfort into the kitchen, while Fawn follows in her plain, stockinged feet. While the tea steeps, Greta opens her present, a woven skirt in shades of blue with a fringed hemline. Fawn gets a stained glass window, which Greta says is for her outhouse. You can enjoy it when the pipes freeze, Greta tells her. Several of the cabins have an outhouse for such emergency use. Oh, but it's so beautiful. You really don't want me to put it out there, do you? Fawn laughs. Of course. It'll look great against the old weathered wood, don't you think? They are both anxious to see how it will look. Greta reaches behind her and grabs a letter from the counter. She holds it out so Fawn can see who it's from. The Thunder Bay Shrink? That's right. Dr. Willie Winkle. He wants to visit me. Says he has business in Red Otter. Of course, no one ever has business in Red Otter, especially in winter. He got my address from the craft shop. Says while he's here, he wants to commission another stained glass piece. Could you do a snow scene with some rabbits, she reads. I would like it if they were quite cheerful. And could you put in a few pine trees? 7 would be nice. How is the toothbrush holding up? Greta shakes her head as she pours tea. What will you do? Fawn asks. I don't know. Any ideas? They ponder the situation in silence as they sip their tea. Can I see the moccasins again? Fawn asks. Greta slips off both slippers and they each fondle one of the baby soft moccasins and end up laughing at the same time. Crazy. We're sitting here like a couple of shoe fetishists, Greta says. I wonder what Dr. Winkle would say. They are museum quality, though, Greta. You mean I shouldn't wear them? Maybe put them in a glass case or hang them on the wall? Oh, I don't think so. He made them for me to wear, I'm sure. I think I should wear them. I don't want to be one of those people who save their quilts and heirlooms in a trunk never use them, never use anything beautiful. Like Dorothy said, why wait for a trip to the moon? Mars, actually, Fawn says. I suppose, she reluctantly hands back the slipper. You know, maybe his wife made them. Do you think? Could be. No, a man made these. I just know it. My visitor during the storm, I'm sure, though I don't know why I'm so sure. Greta holds the moccasin away from her and lifts it up and down as if weighing the shoe. Anyway, I'm thinking of adding a workroom on the lakeside with a big picture window. I was talking to Tom, and he thinks I could have the big window if I use double-strength glass. You'll have to put up dark bird silhouettes like I do at the top of my A-frame to keep the birds from crashing into the glass. They still do sometimes anyway. But it's a great idea, Fawn. So you think the man with the long black hair made the moccasins? I do, Greta says, slipping the moccasins on her feet. I feel confined by the small pieces. I need to work larger, do some windows, actual windows, not only pieces to hang in windows. It's more natural, more traditional, and I just need to do larger stained glass pieces. Your outhouse window inspired me. I'll put my drawing table in the new room, and I want a chair like that moose antler chair over at Leto's Lodge. I'm going into town this afternoon to talk to Tom's cousin Otto, who's supposed to be a wonderful carpenter. He works with a builder over at Hornet's Nest. Greta can hardly wait for the room. It's going to be such a wonderful sunny room. On the way home, Fawn remembers the clipping she meant to give Greta about the Nutcracker Ballet in Winnipeg, with the rave review about that dancer, Gabriel Dimitri. But she decides just as well she forgot. Greta would get the paper herself if she wanted outside news, and she always changes the subject whenever Fawn brings up her days as a dancer. Whatever made her clip that out? Greta was so happy today. She speeds up, anxious to get started with the sheepdog wool she bought on their recent trip to Thunder Bay, humming to herself a bit. How little it takes sometimes, just a bit of sheepdog wool, a bit of elk fur stuck to a fence, or a new color, a new shade of yarn. Before she goes into the house, she takes down the fresh strands of golden wool hanging on the clothesline above the fresh snow. Yes, Christmas is wonderful this year. Greta's dream. A kitchen. She leans on the counter at Gabriel's. The counter is in Gabriel's house. He is in the kitchen busy with something, but they seem to be at home together. Several bars of soap are lined up on the counter in a variety of shapes. All are clear glycerin soaps in attractive colors, red, amber, blue, pale green, clear, even black. They seem like large jewels. Gabriel says they are his Christmas presents, and Greta feels bad at first because he got nothing but soap. But then she realizes it's because he always looks so clean, something about his clean-looking face. Or is it because he's dead?
We've been listening to episode 5 of The Ice Dancer, written and read for us by Duluth author Connie Ellis. There will be 12 episodes in this book. Remember, you can always go to our website at ktwh.org, and under the Programs tab is Literally from the North Shore, where you'll find the previous 2 weeks' recordings if you want to go back and hear something again or you missed something. Today we'll fill out the rest of this episode with a story reflecting on Connie's childhood in Duluth. It's called The Korean War.
The Korean War. Hi, Grandpa. Marie, you want some smoked fish? I'm eating before I can answer. He lets me eat with my fingers while he prepares the flaky smoked Cisco into tender pink chunks with his pocket knife and peels back the crackly gold skin. We delight in this smelly fish and eat without talking. He eats with his knife. We love to eat. Sometimes Grandpa slices hard-boiled eggs with his knife, then I get every other slice. I only eat hard-boiled eggs when we share them, because he puts a thick slice of hard butter on each slice of egg so that it tastes good. One of his other recipes is bacon grease sandwiches. They're good, too. I lick my fingers when we finish the fish, and Grandpa cleans his knife and wipes his hands on his all-purpose pocket rag. He wraps up the two remaining Ciscos in brown paper, puts them away in the icebox. The kitchen smells powerfully of smoked fish, like the sweet smoke from the sauna when the fire is first lit, only more fishy. "You better wash up," Grandpa tells me, and I hurry because I can see Philip crossing the lawn. I'm ready by the time he calls me for the war. Philip and I sit on the front steps and watch the Korean War. We always do this after kindergarten. We could get a better view further up the hill, but we can't cross 13th Street, so we just sit on the top step and watch it across Lake Superior. We are most interested in seeing bombs, but we haven't seen a single explosion yet. Since the U.S. Coast Guard ice cutter broke up the ice, we've had plenty of boats to watch floating on the lake. Mainly, we see the long, brick-colored U.S. steel ore boats coming down the lake to load up with iron ore brought to Duluth by train from the Iron Range. We also see tugboats almost every day in the harbor, and for 2 weeks, a big gray ship sat anchored out in the lake flying a yellow flag. That meant it had rats, so it wasn't allowed to pass through the canal to enter the harbor. Then suddenly, the boat vanished during the night. That happened last week. Today, we are watching our favorite ship, the beautiful white ship from South America that delivers Arco coffee. People drink a lot of coffee around here. My mom has coffee parties and uses her fancy cups with roses in the bottom. Philip and I talk about how coffee makes people laugh a great deal when they're together at coffee parties, but it makes them quiet when they drink it alone after supper, listening to the radio. I get a sugar lump to dip in my mom's coffee. Philip says he sometimes drinks a cup of cold coffee, but he doesn't really like it. He's trying to develop a taste for it, he tells me. From here on the hill, we see mostly a blue. A huge flat blue, sky blue on top and dark lake blue on the bottom. Into this landscape, the ship from South America appears like a white vision that makes Philip and me stand to see it better. Our sense of honor also makes us stand, though no one is looking at us. It's our homage to beauty and to coffee. I can see my Aunt Solway and my other grandpa out on his porch on 13th Street watching the white ship. Mrs. Lillegard is watching from her yard next door. Looks like Brownie, the Johnson's dog, is watching too, but Philip's dog, Minnie, is sleeping on the front porch of his house. We stand until the coffee ship passes under the aerial bridge and is safely into the harbor. This is the ship I draw at school with crayons, making the white ship waxy and shiny with my white crayon. I color the surrounding blue thick enough to hold up the boat. I use up my crayons pretty fast and break a lot of them because I press too hard, but I make beautiful pictures. I'm failing fingernails, though. This morning I got an X again for the week on the fingernail chart instead of the red star I want, all because someone bites off my fingernails while I sleep. Philip does well in fingernails, but he prefers coloring the long, straight oar boats on a lake of waves, which he makes with little blue points. We have other distractions from watching the war besides the boats. The U.S. Air Force base is just over the hill, and we often see planes flying in formation above the lake, so loud we have to cover our ears. I think today will be our last day to watch the Korean War. Its complete lack of bombs is disappointing, especially after we've waited all this time. We haven't so much as seen a fire across the lake. We can hear my grandpa sawing wood in the backyard, where he's making a slide. We go around back and see how he's coming. There are 6 stairs on the slide, and he's been using the plane on the sliding part all week. The shavings from the planing are curly and new-looking on the green grass, so I put one on my finger for a ring. I hate when Grandpa gets wood slivers, because he sits on the kitchen chair and digs out the sliver with his pocket knife, and his face stays just the same as always, no matter how big or deep the sliver. I always watch him dig it out, though, even though I hate it. I think he's so tough because he ate bear meat once in Norway. He said it was awful and real greasy. The bear was killing sheep, so someone shot it and hung it up in a tree. That was back when foxes were a problem. My grandpa says the foxes in Norway were so sneaky they could hypnotize a chicken with a single glance. I ask him to tell about the foxes and the chickens over and over, but I only need to hear about the bear once. We have problems with bears in Minnesota, too. When we go to the lake, we can sometimes hear them banging around the garbage cans. Sometimes they growl, but they sound like babies when they cry. If they come too close, my mom says, just bang some pots and pans together and they'll go away. My dad says they're deer. If they come at night when we camp out, just some deer. Sometimes there's a storm coming on. When we're out blueberry picking and we suddenly have to rush off to the boats with our pails, it's because of the storm coming on. I heard it growl once, though, so I don't waste any time getting on the boat. Here in town, the only bear is the one that lives under the pine tree across the street at Jackie Murphy's house. She's 7 years old and warned me about it. I can smell it by that tree. You have to go past it to get to her house. It's no place to linger. Philip laughs at me about the bear, because there's no hole under the tree, just dirt and pine needles. Grandpa, can Philip and I go down the creek? I ask. Okay, Grandpa says as he saws. We take the hill down to the upper creek where the thimbleberries grow. Thimbleberries have leaves as big as elephant ears, and we use them to make clothing for ourselves, sticking the long stems into our waistbands so they don't fall off. We are natives and cook dinner of mashed thimbleberries down by the edge of the creek on the big sandstone rock. We have to pretend the fire. After dinner, we sing Our Country 'Tis of Thee, and then we hear Philip's mother calling from the top of the hill, Philip, Philip, get up here right this minute. We go up and take those leaves off. They're poisonous. You want to be poisoned? As usual, we take off our green Garden of Eden clothes and Philip goes home. Bye. He looks back at me, smiling. The teachers say he has a $1 million smile. I go back to Grandpa. What's the matter, he says, seeing Philip go off and me pouting. Stuck is a little Maria. Poor little Marie. I got some string today. You can help me after supper, he tells me. Now I'm happy again. This is one of the best things to do after supper. First we go to the basement and do a few rows on our rag rug, weaving. And then, when David and my mom finish the dishes, we start on the string. Grandpa gets it from a fisherman friend up the North Shore, from his nets, and it's just a mess of tangles when we start on it. I sit on the kitchen floor and start unraveling by pulling out some of the longer strands. Then I pull the longest string through itself and loop it and unloop the puzzle of it till I start getting longer and longer sections of string. Grandpa works at his kitchen chair. Sometimes he has to get out his knife if we get a really bad tangle, but that's definitely a last resort. Grandpa and I really love string untangling. We forget about the clock when we're untangling. The kitchen is a mess while we work, looking like a clumsy giant spider has taken over, because I hook sections on the drawer knobs. But we end up with nice balls of strong white string. You can use the string for a lot of things, such as tying up bundles of newspaper, for stringing up sweet peas in the garden. When we finish for the evening, we have 5 good-sized balls of string and some leftover tangles to put away in a cardboard box down by the coal bin. Even my fingers are tired. I hope I don't work on string in my dreams. That happens sometimes. Everybody says good night, see you in the morning, which means good luck, don't die in your sleep. I love you and hope you get through the dark night. My dad reads a chapter of Blackie the Crow, my favorite book. Then I talk to my friend under the covers, and as usual, try to picture eternity in the night, the stars in the night sky going on and on and on without end until I fall asleep.